This episode of the Children's Literature Podcast is brought to you by Shirts with Loud Flowery Prints. Shirts with Loud Flowery Prints. They will hide the stains from whatever your kids wiped on you, so you don't have to change your clothes halfway through your cousin's wedding reception. Welcome to the Children's Literature Podcast. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. Today, we'll discuss the characteristics of a good baby book. But first, I wanted to share a fun poem I found by author B.C. Byron. He writes silly, lighthearted poems in a style similar to that of Shel Silverstein, with pleasantly repeating rhythmic patterns and funny, simple drawings as accompanying pieces. This poem is called Kaleidoscope, and I'm sharing it with you today with the author's permission. I got a new kaleidoscope, a twisty, turny funoscope, a jewels and games incidoscope, a gazing's never done a scope, a flashy fascination scope, a countless combination scope. They glued it to my ioscope, a not-so-funny prankoscope, and though I pull and pry a scope, no matter how I yank a scope, I don't have any luck-a-scope. It stays forever stuck-a-scope. A warning for the punk-a-scope who pasted my kaleidoscope. That rotten little skunk-a-scope had better run and hide-a-scope. I had a good laugh when I read that poem. I like unexpected twists, and I really like humor that is dark, but absurd enough that it's enjoyable rather than depressing. The poem works because the scope endings provide an anchor for each phrase, while words in the middle rhyme, sometimes in couplets, and other times in alternating lines. It's a loose, ever-changing structure, kind of like the inside of a kaleidoscope. Another of his poems I really liked was called Clean Your Plate, which is a good one to recite to a kid who's refusing to eat dinner. You should check out B.C. Byron's work. It's a lot of fun. He's on Instagram at B.C. Byron Poetry, that's Byron with a Y, and he has a website at bcbyron.com. Today's show is about how to identify a good baby book versus one that is a waste of your time and money. This show is not about making parents feel pressured to select the perfect literature at the risk of their babies experiencing suboptimal development. The cultural trends which encourage helicopter parenting and a constant state of worry and guilt over parenting choices are evil and vile things. I want to do everything I can to fight them. So breathe easy, listeners. I'm just here to present some fun facts about infant neuroscience so that you can have more fun interacting with your kid, avoid wasting money on a book that won't be enjoyed, and have more magical wow moments as you watch your little one progress in his or her natural development. There are a lot of educational theorists with varying ideas about the best way to educate children. I've been heavily influenced by Jean Piaget, who argued that children move through predictable, natural stages of development, and that the best thing to do is just support that development. There's no need to tamper with the pace. In fact, to do so might cause harm. Parents are often targeted with products that claim to make your baby smarter or help a child reach a milestone faster. Scientifically, this is nonsense. Parents have a lot of influence over how well-adjusted their kids are or whether they have a good work ethic or strong sense of empathy. But don't waste your money on baby flashcards or videos where someone says random words in a foreign language you're never going to speak with your kid. You can't force development, nor should you. You're being ripped off with these products and sold the pernicious idea that the right consumer products will help you engineer a better child. Instead of trying to choose books for your kids based on some developmental target off in the future, give your kids books that match their current needs, that are enjoyable, and that you can read together over and over. So, what is a good baby book? Let's start with a literal definition. A good baby book is sturdy. I've seen some babies who are very gentle with books, and others who actively try to destroy them as if there is some kind of vendetta going on. Buy a book for a baby assuming it will be dropped, sat on, chewed on, slobbered on, grabbed by sticky fingers. You get the idea. A book has to hold up to that, or you have to accept that the book will be loved to death. Most baby books come in board format, but some don't, and that's okay. These are not holy relics. They're meant to be used, and a little wear and tear just shows that the book is being appreciated. When it gets worn out, you can get a new one. They're not expensive, and it's easy to find free books in neighborhood little libraries or online groups that help people give things away to each other. On another practical point, you need to choose a book based on how well you can tolerate reading it 8,000 times. It's easy to get frustrated with how many times a little child wants to hear the exact same 6-page book over and over again, but I'd like to encourage you to be patient with this. Think of the books and movies that you've enjoyed over and over again. Like, I've watched The Hunt for Red October at least 50 times. And you know what? I notice something new every time. Maybe it's the way a particular scene is framed, or maybe it's an item of wardrobe a character is wearing. But whatever it is, I learn something new. I'm sure that you have your own books and movies that you revisit and learn from over and over again. So now imagine how much more intense that experience is to a 1-year-old. I'm not saying it won't be boring reading The Very Hungry Caterpillar for the 1,000th time. It will. But it isn't to your kid, and that's quite important. Luckily, the kinds of books that you can tolerate through multiple readings tend to be the kind of books that are also high-quality experiences for babies. So now that we've got a book that your adorable little rugrat can use as a chew toy, but which won't melt your brain, what should be in the book? Pictures, of course. Simple, high-contrast pictures of easily recognized objects. The kind of pictures an adult might find boring. Adult brains are really good at identifying patterns. Babies' brains are equipped with everything they need to identify patterns, but they need training first. Little ones enter the world and see blobs moving around with dark spots in the middle of them. Through repetition and statistical analysis, they learn that these blobs are faces. They hear the rhythms of sound coming from those faces over and over again, until they learn that these rhythms are words. They see drawings and gradually come to recognize them as abstract representations of real life on a flat surface. It's amazing to witness. So let's help their brains out by giving them what they need. Complicated pictures are going to be meaningless to babies who are still laying foundational neural connections. Monet paintings are gorgeous things to see, but they'd make terrible images for a baby book with their soft, blurry focus, lack of clear lines, and mottled pastel colors running into one another. Pictures in a good baby book have high contrast colors, very simple lines, familiar and easily recognized objects, and no particular care for a proper 3-dimensional perspective. And what kind of plot should a good baby book have? None at all. Babies' brains are different from our brains. Plot, character development, exposition, narrative flow, all that stuff I'm usually very nitpicky about in children's literature goes right out the window when I'm picking a baby book. Babies are going to enjoy something with a repetitive, rhythmic style, and it's best if there's some action they can perform as the story moves along. Two books that give good examples of all this are Pat the Bunny by Dorothy Kuhnhart and Goodnight Moon by Margaret Wise Brown and Clement Hurd. They were both published in the 1940s, but are still bestsellers. I believe they remain classics because they contain the elements that make them comprehensible and enjoyable for babies. Pat the Bunny is a little book that features a boy and a girl called Paul and Judy. They are represented with very simple line drawings, and a baby will easily recognize them as children. Kids love to see pictures and play with dolls that look like them, so it's great that both sexes are represented. Paul and Judy are introduced, and then on each page, Paul or Judy does something. Then the reader's invited to do the same thing using an interactive element on the page. Judy pats a bunny, and then the book says, "Now you pat the bunny." Then, ideally, the baby strokes a patch of fake fur set into the page, outlined in the shape of a bunny. Adults or older kids will sometimes say, "That doesn't look like a bunny," and it doesn't. It's an extremely simplified image that represents a rabbit, not an anatomically correct diagram. There's no nose, no whiskers, and the paws are just kind of simple blobs. A baby can process that, so as adults, we shouldn't look at it and think, "Wow, what a crummy drawing of a rabbit." Instead, we should think, "Wow, what a developmentally appropriate drawing of a rabbit." Babies' brains add new information as very general categories, then slowly subdivide those categories. As an example, my oldest daughter called anything that was furry and four-legged a cat until she was about 2. Squirrel? It's a cat. Dog? It's a cat. Bear? Definitely a cat. Her developing brain recognized a collection of general traits that often show up together. Walking on all fours, furry, projecting nose, whiskers, claws. And the first label she was given for that collection was the word cat, because there were 2 of them in the house. It was not until later that she'd had time to do scientific fieldwork that she noticed that there were increasingly subtle differences between all of these cats. There was never any need to correct her, because that just would have made her think she was doing something wrong. She naturally added to her mental database until she realized on her own that some cats were squirrels, dogs, and bears. So when babies see this simple blobby bunny in Pat the Bunny, the same thing is happening. Because bunny is only a very general idea to an infant, there's no need for whiskers, toes, or lines detailing the fur. The furry bunny that the child pats is even more abstract than the drawn image being just a rabbit-shaped black outline surrounding a fur cutout. It doesn't need any detail at all. The book is not called "Witness an Accurate Representation of a Bunny." It's called "Pat the Bunny." Just pat it like Judy does. Nicely. I have the copy of Pat the Bunny that belonged to me as a baby. The back cover is long gone and it's a little battered, but it's interesting to see that the contents are pretty much exactly the same as the modern editions I've bought for my kids. The flap of cloth that you use to play peekaboo with Paul is exactly the same shade of blue. The flowers you smell have exactly that same car air freshener scent. I'd actually love to be able to buy a Pat the Bunny scented air freshener, so hey, Random House Books, you make that merch happen and I'll give you my money. The only difference I can see between the vintage edition and the current one is that Judy's book, a 4-page mini book within the book, is made of slightly sturdier paper now. It's a good upgrade that made it a little more difficult for my toddler to rip it out. This book hasn't had to change to stay relevant because it connects perfectly with a developing baby's mind. There are no backgrounds to the pictures, so little ones can focus on the actions happening on the page. Every page has something easily recognizable. Patting the bunny is nice, but kids just light up when they turn the page and see that they can now play peekaboo. "I know this," they say to themselves. "I can do this." You smell flowers, but then you get the most immersive experience in the book. You look in a mirror. Every baby who has done this has become part of the story. You flip through Judy's book, which shows Bunny listening, raising his arms, eating, and sleeping. These are all activities a baby will recognize and be able to imitate. Every activity is presented with a rhythmic mantra. First, something is done by Paul or Judy. Then, the text says, "Now you do what Paul or Judy did." The last activity shows Mummy holding her ring. There's a cutout in the page so the child can put his or her finger through it. If you'll notice, the ring is not accurately adult-sized. I can barely get my pinky through it. It's perfect for a child, though. In the most tangible sense, the page tells us that this book is not for adults. The conclusion is sweet and simple. That's all. Bye-bye. Can you say bye-bye? Goodnight Moon is the standard bedtime book in the United States. It's also another book that adults with no understanding of how young minds work smugly dismiss as a poorly drawn, substandard story without a plot. And these adults are totally, utterly, and completely wrong. Like Pat the Bunny, Goodnight Moon also has a rabbit as the main character, except this one is anthropomorphized as a little kid. He's wearing pajamas and has been tucked into bed in the great green room, a description I love because when you look at the perspective in the drawings, you can see how the room is only big from a child's point of view. To the quiet old lady whispering hush, it's probably a pretty ordinary bedroom. The images in Pat the Bunny are very minimalist, and the colors are pale pastels. This is because the child should not be distracted from the physical actions the story invites. In contrast, Goodnight Moon is visually rich, with saturated colors. Every image is loaded with things to look at, because rather than grabbing and touching parts of the book, the action the child is invited to do is to scan the image for the item that is currently being mentioned. It's like a very relaxed version of Where's Waldo, or Where's Wally for my British listeners. On each page, the reader helps the little bunny say goodnight to everything in the room. Socks, clocks, kittens, mittens, a comb and a brush, and a bowl full of mush. Unlike Pat the Bunny, the images in this book are intense and full of things to look at. The curtains in the room get a lot of comments from adults who object to the ugly, loud striping. Calm down. You're not buying the curtains to put up in your living room. You're just letting your baby appreciate how different bright orange is from dark green. When you look at the pictures in Goodnight Moon, pay attention to how much the colors contrast. This makes it easy for a baby to make out the shapes. Most parents who use this book as part of a bedtime routine find that the repetitive, lulling pattern of saying goodnight to every recognizable object or person in the field of view is incredibly soothing and reassuring to a little one. After the story is done, a baby or toddler is very happy to say goodnight to the things in their own room and then cooperatively get in bed and go to sleep without a fight. We hope. The point of Goodnight Moon is not plot or character development. The point is a reassuring pattern that helps fix familiar objects around a small child, providing a steady frame of reference and a feeling of safety. But when the kid's a teenager, go back to this book, read the blank white page that says, "Goodnight Nobody," and blow their minds with the fact that they were reading the kind of stuff that can trigger an existential crisis while they were still in diapers. Infants are extremely literal in their thinking. They don't even get object permanence until they are 4 to 8 months old. That means if they can't see something right now, it ceases to exist to them. Full object permanence, in which a child can think of something, hold it in mind, and use that mental image to solve problems, doesn't finish developing until the age of 2. A baby simply can't follow a story with a plot because that requires neural processes which are still under construction. But a baby can begin to recognize familiar objects and build a sense of security by using them to anchor the corners of a tiny but ever-expanding world. As an adult choosing books for a baby, remind yourself of this. Understandably, most adults don't know about these topics because they're not specialists in child development. But it's still frustrating when some grown-ups trash-talk this book. Others, though, seem to pay attention and intuitively recognize that the book works perfectly, even if they don't understand the technical reasons why. Funny enough, the best examples of these two viewpoints are found in the top 2 ratings of Goodnight Moon on the British Amazon website. The most popular review complains that Goodnight Moon is not a book that lends itself to being read aloud, because there is no scope for interesting voices, gestures, or noises, and the black and white illustrations on certain pages are very boring. The point of Goodnight Moon is not to take little ones on a thrilling adventure. It's a bedtime book. Interesting voices, gestures, and noises are the opposite of what you should be doing to put a child to sleep. In criticizing the black and white images in the book, this person has made the mistake of calling them boring, when in fact their simplicity makes them clear. The images are only boring if you fail to appreciate the beauty of an uncluttered scene. Thank goodness, the second most popular review actually understands what Goodnight Moon is, even though the author isn't an expert on early childhood development. Quote, "When I first bought this book for my little girl, I didn't get it. There are no bells and whistles, there's no action, there are very few characters or animals. Even the rhyme feels too simple. But over time, I realized this is exactly the right type of book to soothe your little one and to give them comfort and familiarity. We don't read this book every night, but when we do, it's like a mantra. And sometimes when there's sore teeth or a nightmare or a cold, it's exactly what's needed. It's like medicine for the mind, and not just for your child." End quote. It's like a mantra. Exactly. In fact, it's not like a mantra. It is a mantra. And mantras absolutely can be medicine for the mind, for children and adults. When it's done as a healthy form of meditation, repeating reassuring, soothing phrases to yourself is a great way to clear away the clutter of the day, quieting the mind to prepare for rest. The mental effect of Goodnight Moon is not that different from that of chanting in preparation for some forms of Buddhist meditation, if you really think about it. You don't need to do a lot of heavy research into early childhood development to choose good baby books and enjoy reading them with your little one. All you need to do is remember that these books aren't for you. The experience of reading them to a baby, that's what's for you. Pay attention to how your baby reacts to books. Don't try to force or even encourage a particular reaction. Just observe and see what you learn. That does mean that sometimes your toddler will want you to read the same short book 6 times in a row. It means that sometimes you'll have to go back and forth or read pages out of order. That's fine. Just go with it. Babies have a lot to take in, and they won't always want to experience books in a straight line from front to back the way an adult does. If you're interested in learning a bit more about the mental development of babies, but don't have time to earn a PhD in infant neuroscience, I recommend the Netflix documentary called, appropriately, Babies. Babies does a very good job of summarizing the current state of science when it comes to infant cognition. It explains scientifically what parents and caregivers already know anecdotally, that babies understand words months before they can speak them, and it's magical to watch little ones develop their speech. While I think the entire series is excellent, the episodes First Words and What Babies Know are most relevant to early experiences with books. I always include a teaching activity at the end of each episode, but there's not much point in designing a formal lesson for a baby. So this activity is for adults who want to learn more about babies, or maybe some older brothers and sisters who want to help. The first step is to find a baby to whom you can read a story. If you don't have your own baby, I promise it's super easy to borrow one. Just think of a mom you know, call her up and say, "Can I borrow your baby for a little while and you can have a nap?" Then she'll say, "How soon can you get here?" Before you hang out with the baby, get a couple of baby books, ideally ones that have the traits we've discussed. No plot, no character development, simple, high-contrast illustrations, actions the child is invited to imitate, and repetitive patterns that soothe and reinforce with rhythmic language. Next, start reading a book to the baby. But don't try to read it the way you would read it. If the kid loses interest, toss it aside and get another one. If the baby wants to flip back and hear another page again, flip back and start reading that page again. Allow the child to direct what's going on completely and just observe what is happening rather than attempting to influence anything. Which book is the baby most drawn to? Is there a page that attracts the most interest? How many times did the little one want you to read the book before moving on to another activity? As adults, it's easy for us to unthinkingly impose our logic on a situation because, well, that's usually for the best. But there are some situations where we can really learn a lot by making space for a child, even a very little child, to show us what's going on inside that little mind. You've been listening to the Children's Literature Podcast. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts and give the show a rating. Send comments to letters@childrensliteraturepodcast.com. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. Thanks for listening.